Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. We are back in the suburbs. Not that we've ever really left them. Recently, we've done a series of shows about the meaning politically, culturally, economically of the suburbs. We did one with the American writer, the Philadelphia-based writer, Benjamin Herold, on suburbia and American disillusionment. He has a book, Disillusioned, about the death of the American dream, reflected in the changing nature of the American suburbs. Meanwhile, even the word suburb has been stretched, making it increasingly suburban or exurban. Recently, we did a show, with David Masciotra, who has a new book out called Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy, in which he traces the future of American democracy, not in the suburbs, but in the very far suburbs, which he calls exurbia. And as I said, we're back in the suburbs today with my guest, Matt Hearn. He's based in Richmond, British Columbia, just outside Vancouver. And he has a new book out, Outside the Outside, The New Politics of Sub-Urbs. I'm not sure if that's a new word or his treatment of suburbs. Matt, as I said, is joining us from Richmond on a houseboat of all places. Matt, is that the future of the city or the future of the suburbs?
Well, it was the future for my family after our inner city neighbor got a little too expensive for us. Thanks a lot for having me. I appreciate that. And I'm sitting out here on unceded Musqueam waters just outside of Vancouver, BC.
So, Matt, you've thrown your hat in the ring. You've already written a number of other books about the city. A lot of your work has focused on the city. You wrote a book, I think, in 2017, MIT book, What is a City For? You've written about something called the liquid city. I'm not entirely sure what that means. So you've given a lot of thought to this stuff. Are you arguing in this new book, Outside the Outside, The New Politics of Suburbs, that we need to redefine not so much suburbs, but cities?
I think so. I think in a lot of respects, this book is posed as a challenge to our conception of the city and to traditional and radical urban studies thinking. In a lot of ways, the book traces my own thinking and tries to chart it kind of in real time, but also the movement of where I live and my work. I lived in a classic inner city neighborhood for almost 30 years. I raised my family on what's called Commercial Drive here, which is a kind of neighborhood that'll be very familiar to you and to, I presume, all your listeners, a place that, you know, something like used to be like the Mission or like to be the Lower East Side of New York City. It was walkable. It was dense. It was full of cheap rent. It was full of artists and activists and organizers and immigrants from all over the world. But in the course of my tenure there, rents, housing prices got steadily more and more expensive. Everybody that I knew was being forced to move further and further from the neighborhood. My children and my family were no longer to be able to afford to live there. The neighborhood changed in all the kinds of predictable ways, becoming bougier and wider. And we looked up, my partner and I looked up about 5 or 6 years ago, personally, and just realized that hardly anybody that we knew lived anywhere close to us anymore. And that the same house that we had rented for 26 years had crept up. And even though we are middle-class, middle-aged white people, it had crept up to the very far edges of what we could afford. And so that was part of my instigation for writing this book, is our own personal family experience.
So in a sense, coming back to the suburbs, Herold, as I said, and I know you're familiar with both these works, Herold's book, Disillusion, suggests that the suburbs have become, so to speak, the graveyard of the American dream of increasing inequality and injustice. I think in some ways Masciotra makes the same argument, except that he shifts his focus from the suburbs to the exurbs. Are you saying the same thing, that the broken dream, the broken urban dream now, can not just be found in the suburbs and exurbs, but also in the city itself?
Yeah, I think I argue something substantively different than both of those books, even though I like both of them for lots of different kinds of reasons. Let me tell you this, though, because not only did my family move out of the inner city and out into a suburb. So yeah, we are in a houseboat, but we're on the edge of a relatively sprawling classic suburb. But about 10 years ago, an old man who had appointed himself my mentor looked at my work in East Vancouver, and I had been doing classic kind of, you know, do-gooder, bleeding heart, white person community organizing for about 30 years in East Van. We'd run schools, we run youth centers, we've started festivals, run all kinds of community organizations. And this old guy looked at me and he said, "Matt, you're East Vancouver you think you're living in, it's not in East Vancouver anymore. It's in Surrey. And Surrey is not the Surrey of London. Surrey is a very different place. It is a gigantic sprawling suburb on the outskirts of Vancouver that is synonymous with like poverty and low income and trashiness. But 30 years ago or 40 years ago or 50 years ago in Vancouver, when any immigrant family would arrive in Vancouver, they would land in East Vancouver. People from all over the world would arrive in the city and unless they were carrying a ton of money in their pockets, they would settle in East Vancouver, which made that place such a diverse and such a vibrant place. Now, of course, though, due to the incredible gentrification and displacement of the city that mirrors that of so many other places in the world, those immigrants are never going to land and settle in the inner city. They are going to bypass that entirely and move out to the suburbs. They're going to move to a place called Coquitlam. They're going to move to Burnaby. They're going to move to Langley. But more than anywhere else, they're going to move to Surrey. And I recognize that the low income, the working class, and primarily the migrant families that I've been working with for generations were no longer in the inner city. They were all in the suburbs and in various kinds of suburbs. And there's something about the taxonomy of suburbs that I find tiresome, but also I find super interesting. And so I think Surrey is a classic, like Richmond, is a classic immigrant suburb now, sprawling, car dependent, hardly any walkable districts. But it is a place where all the most vibrant organizing in Vancouver is happening now. It's happening not in the inner city like it used to, like it did in so many other cities around North America and across the globe, but they're happening on the edges of the city, which might be called the suburbs. I'm fine. I'm not fighting that word, but I'm also thinking about it in terms of the dash in between the sub and the herb is me getting a bit cutesy, which is to think about the suburb in its classical terms, which is beneath or underneath the city.
I know your book focuses on a number of case studies of cities and suburbs, Portland, Ferguson, London, Vancouver, but in your description of your thesis, two cities come to mind: Paris, which seems to be exhibit A in what's happened, and also Los Angeles. I was thinking of Mike Davis's City of Quartz, I think is a classic book about Los Angeles, in which he presents LA back in the 70s or 80s as being what you're describing. So perhaps you might address both Paris and Davis's Los Angeles.
Totally. And this is where I started to get curious, because, you know, I had always assumed that the most important, the most lively, the most vibrant community organizing and activist work was always going to happen in the inner city. You know, for me, the phrase inner city was always coded as low income, as immigrant, as black, as vibrant. But for my kids now, the word inner city means something else again. And for young people, the word inner city means high-end condoization. It means unaffordable districts. It means
it's Brooklyn. It's Paris. It's Hackney in London.
Totally.
It's San Francisco for people who actually have the good fortune to have to live indoors.
Totally. And, you know, and so I came to it slowly. So I started like recognizing this myself slowly with my own families, where I live and where I work. And all of a sudden I found myself both living and working in these suburban areas that I would never have anticipated when I was a young person ever, you know, setting foot in. I just had, you know, coded suburb in my mind as white, as black holes of culture, of, you know, just absolute like places I would never want to set foot in, or
places that people would vote for Trump or totally. Marine Le Pen.
Totally. And so all of a sudden I found myself slowly and frankly reluctantly coming to these realizations. And then I began to ask, like, to me, you know, like, is this true just in Vancouver? Because Vancouver is such an incredibly unaffordable place and such an exemplar of neoliberal urbanism. And I was wondering, I was like, is this, does this happen anywhere else? Is this, or is this just an anomaly? And I began to look around, and certainly, and Mike Davis was certainly part of that, part of my thinking. Mike was an old friend and colleague who began to point me in these directions. And I thought of course, of Ben Luz, and I thought of Paris right away. And I don't know much about Paris, but I was wondering, is that just an anomaly? And so I began to, like, everywhere I travel, and I don't travel that much, frankly, but places that I've been and studied, places like Portland, places like St. Louis, places like London, places like Rabat and Morocco, I began just to ask people, like, is this happening here? And I kept getting the same answer over and over again, which was sort of a somewhat, like, dismissive, yeah, of course regular people can't live in the inner city anymore. It's far too expensive. And it just, it began to slowly shock me. And in part because, partially because I, how had I not, you know, taken me so long to notice this exactly?
Well, I think that basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, yours is the next step in the Harold Masciotra argument. You talk about something, I hadn't heard this term, but it makes sense in your argument, neoliberal urbanism. You're rediscovering the suburb or the contemporary suburb. You're arguing, of course, it's not ideal. It's not 19th century Paris or some other urban utopia, but it's where the real people live. Is that your argument? And that's not only where the real people live, but where the real politics is and where the real future is.
Yeah. Yeah. In short, yes. It sort of shocked me because the first place I went to was Portland, because like you noted there in that book, What a City is For, I had studied the gentrification and the racial cleansing of this particular neighborhood in Portland, this area called Albina.
That's a strong term, Matt, racial cleansing. I mean, we're talking about Milosevic-style racial cleansing.
It's Portland's single, what was at one point was Portland's only majority black neighborhood. And from 1990 to 2010, the city deliberately moved out more than 12,000 of its residents and dispersed its only, you know, majority minority neighborhood. And so I had studied that neighborhood, and what was remarkable to me is that I spent years focused on this neighborhood, like looking at this neighborhood, studying it, talking to people, researching, reading about it, and then I somehow didn't pay attention to where those people had gone. And I'm entirely chagrined about it and embarrassed about
don't shame yourself. I know you wrote a piece in The Guardian about not shaming ourselves or castigating ourselves over the environment. So you shouldn't do it for yourself. You're certainly thinking ahead of a lot of other people. So you're finding, so where did those people go? The people who, in your language at least, had been racially cleansed from downtown Portland to make it a very cool place of lofts and wealthy young entrepreneurs and tech startup types. Where did they go?
Yeah, you know, and that was super interesting because then I started, I went back to Portland and I reconnected with a bunch of my friends and interlocutors and was like, where did those people go? And so we began to follow them. And so in this book, I go out to a neighborhood called Gresham, which is a suburb outside of Portland. And I began to investigate that exact same question. It's like, where and how did people go? And what happens when they went somewhere? I know what happens to people in Richmond and in Surrey, and I know what that looks like, and I know what organizing looks like, and I know how it changes our conception of the city. But I began to investigate that in other places, and what I found was not a universalizing pattern. It's not the same thing everywhere. It's happening in fits and starts, and it's happening in fractured ways, but the same pattern is evident all over the place.
And coming back to Mike Davis, who was remarkably prescient as a, I guess, one of the early critics of what you call neoliberal urbanism. Is the world becoming like the Los Angeles of Davis's work?
It's interesting. Yeah, and I'm not Nostradamus-y enough to guess if that's the future, if that kind of fractured urbanism is our future, but it does feel like it. And Mike was ahead of that game in all kinds of ways, in part because, you know, a lot of ways, Los Angeles is, it has that kind of velocity and that kind of urban speed of restructuring and that kind of aggressive securitization that has become the norm in so many cities and so many inner cities that we're familiar with. So I'm not sure about that, but I postulate that in fact, this is actually an urban norm. And certainly in the global South, certainly places like Brazil and Argentina and lots of Latin America, the idea of poor people congregating on the outskirts of city is the norm, like it has been in Paris for so long. And I postulate in the book that maybe in North America and in part of Western Europe, it is just the post-war gigantic infusion of cash into the great highway build-out that interrupted that that historical flow, that idea of inner cities as being for wealthy and privileged and poor and working class and racialized residents being ordered on the outside of the city. Maybe we just encountered a 50-year-old lacuna in that urban narrative.
Matt, you know better than I do that it's not quite as simple as the way you're presenting it. Poor people moving out to the suburbs, the wealthy, the privileged moving into the inner city. You also have the question of homelessness. I was in LA last month and I was astonished with the level of homelessness. I guess I shouldn't have been astonished given I'm from San Francisco, but in some ways it seems to have outbid San Francisco as the urban center of homelessness. How does the homeless encampments, how does it fit into your thesis on neoliberal urbanism, this new city and the new suburbs? I mean, I'm guessing that there's not a lot of homelessness in the suburbs. All the homelessness is in the inner city.
It's in some ways, but in other ways, not at all. And I think that, like you correctly point out, any simple narrative, there's a guy called Alan Earhart who wrote a book about mostly about Chicago, postulating this great inversion of, you know, during the 1950s to 1980s, wealthy and white people moved out to the suburbs and poor people occupied the inner city. And then it just kind of has been reversed. And there's something there, but that's too simple and too reductive. It's not like that. It's a fractured landscape. People often talk about that as post-suburbia or to rethink the entire kind of narrative and the arc of what we think about a city is and should be for. And one of the things we know about, for example, large concentrations of wealthy people is that one of the things they need around them is low-wage workers. They need people to walk their dogs, to make them coffees, to clean their houses, to sweep their streets. And that in the absence, in a flow of urban deindustrialization, there has been huge pockets of inner cities all across the global north that have been abandoned and that have been restructured. We often think of that as in terms of urban lofts and loft living and that kind of thing. Like we think of, say, Pittsburgh, you know, of old mills being refurbished into brick-walled condos. And we recognize that kind of gentrification. But there's other kinds of forces at play. And one of those, of course, is that this incredible, like, acceleration of real estate prices and this fixation on affordability, of course, has seen swaths of homeless people being moved in and out and around of cities all across North America. You probably have more insight into that than a lot of folks living in San Francisco.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about San Francisco is lots of interesting things about San Francisco, but what it's become, you talk about the people servicing the new urban wealthy, which certainly would include myself, people who make the coffee, walk the dogs, drive the Uber cars, this new precariat. But what becomes of the teachers and the policemen and the other workers of the old industrial city? One of the remarkable things about San Francisco, and I'm not sure whether you're seeing this around the world in other cities, you're the urbanist here, is the retreat of the police. I mean, the police are still there for murders and riots and that sort of thing. But basically in San Francisco, the police are no longer on the streets. They're no longer police driving. Anyone can do anything they essentially want in San Francisco. You're not, of course, allowed to rob other people's homes. You can rob cars and the police aren't too bothered. So have you seen a retreat of the public sphere? David Masciocchio wrote about Exurbia being a place where there's no longer any public space. But it seems as if there's a vacuum, an absence of the public in the city. Even if the parks still exist, a lot of the other traditional elements of the public sphere have disappeared.
It's super interesting. And I'm not going to speak to the police exactly because, you know, it's true in some ways that there is an absence of securitization in some ways, but in other ways, just an absolute surfeit of extreme securitization, in particular for, you know, particular communities. But the public sphere, and one of the things I began to note when I first began to spend time in Surrey was that I had no idea how to spend time there. I didn't know where to go. So if you came up to Vancouver right now, I could and say, hey, like, where should I go? I could give you 20 places to get a coffee and to walk around. In Surrey, in many, like many of these suburbs I've encountered in so many places around the world, it's just hard to figure out how to even go there because you don't even know what to do or where to be. There's so few places, like you say, like public spaces to walk around outside of malls. So it's very difficult to begin to be able to kind of get a scope or a scale of to be able to orient yourself in many of these suburbs unless you have someone to take you. And that's the thing that was so interesting is that from my kind of, you know, semi-touristic white guy researcher like stance, I would go to a place and I just wouldn't know where to go. You know, I wouldn't know how to look around on the outskirts of Rabat, Morocco, or the outskirts of Port. I just didn't know what to do because there's nowhere to, no public space. But as soon as I had somebody, if I had somebody who knew the place, who could show me around, those public spaces were different than the classical urbanist, you know, idea of like a square or a walkable neighborhood or a park. But there were so many other places to hang out that just weren't visible to me initially.
Outside the Outside is Matt Hearn's new book, although it's actually, in a sense, Inside the Inside. He's making sense of the outside as the inside. The New Politics of Suburbs. I want to thank our friends at Liberties for helping us bring great guests like Matt Hearn. It's a theme we've been really focusing on, and I know Liberties is very interested in the future of cities too. Going to run a short feature, and then we'll be back with Matt to talk more specifically about the politics of the suburb and what we should be celebrating and what we should be trying to do in the future. So don't go away, anyone.
The noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. So, Matt, much of the work on suburbs is, and the outside of cities is treated it in a dystopian sense. You're, in a sense, celebrating it. What about the political dimensions? The subtitle of the book is about politics, the new politics of suburbs. What are the new politics? It's not necessarily the politics as David Masciotra might argue, the politics of Donald Trump or Marine Le Pen, is it?
That's not my experience. And so I want to speak just briefly about my experience up here and working in Surrey, which is that I found and I could see it and I knew it intellectually that there was this unbelievable vibrancy in these new suburbs because huge populations of low income and racialized and migrant populations were being reordered on the edges of Vancouver. But I just didn't, from my own particular, frankly, kind of bourgeois urbanist sensibilities, I just didn't see it. And like I say, when I first started spending time in Surrey and Richmond, I just had difficulty finding it, finding public places or thinking about how the politics and how my political sensibilities could be reflected and could find kind of a, find a place. And it, frankly speaking, took me a lot of time. But now, after having spent a decade spending all my days working in Surrey and living in Richmond, these two particular suburbs, and spending some extra time visiting suburbs around the world, what I know is that my particular kind of political perspective, you know, a generalized, generalized left thinker and left organizer, is that what was obscure to me was this unbelievable vibrancy and that reordered my thinking about how politics needed to be, how we need to think about urban politics and about urban organizing.
And you're a much, as you say, you're a much experienced urban organizer. You're the guy behind something called Solid State Community Industries. So what exactly should we be celebrating? Color, vitality, vibrancy? How does that manifest itself politically, and how should it be manifested politically?
Yeah, you know, and there's a number of things to think about here for me anyways. And as I, in a lot of ways, the book traces my exploration and my own personal thinking around this. Which is to say that I did. And I began to organize. I spent about 2 years doing research in Surrey. And at first I was chagrined. And resentful. I knew I needed to be in Surrey, but I didn't want to be. I didn't know how to get along. I was in buses forever. I just felt lost all the time. I just didn't know how to orient myself. I couldn't find what I was looking for. But over time, I traced this arc of becoming, and finally, I went to this, you know, to a couple of high schools, there was giant high schools, and there was like two or three white kids, like in these like 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, you know, person schools. And there was just people from all over the world with just an incredible kind of energy among the student population. And I was so intrigued. And then I began to visit churches and gurdwaras and mosques, places that I would never really spend much time before. And I began to find all these other kinds of networks and the ways that people were organizing, and that they were folks that were, yes, from all over the world, but folks that had taken this particular kind of arcs to get there. And just like I found in Portland and in Gresham and in other places, it wasn't that this idea of rootedness was the focus. And that is to say that I, for years and years and years, had subscribed to an idea of community that was focused on rootedness. The idea that to care for a place over time was the apogee of political organizing, that to spend time and to understand it and to be rooted in a community was the way to organize. And I think that's still partially true. But what I'm interested in now, and what I think more about, is the political consequences and the political possibilities of movement and of mobility. And in particular, the motion of people out of the city, but also the motion of people across the globe. And I begin to think much of my work in terms of migrant justice and in thinking of mobilities.
Yeah, I don't exactly know what that means. I mean, there is, of course, the ideology of nomadism, which is very fashionable in tech-centered places like San Francisco, where people say, oh, I don't live anywhere. I live in Berlin and San Francisco and Paris and New York and Vancouver. Is this what you're talking about, this sort of challenge to rootedness? Is this different from that, from this the nomadic lifestyle and ideology of the tech ruling class?
I would say diametrically opposed to that kind of view. So let me give you this. I think about it because of, you mentioned Marine Le Pen. For a long time, I had subscribed to the idea that people who had lived in a place over duration were best suited to be able to care for it. And another person who, you know, other kind of movements that subscribe to that are like the National Front, which is now the National Rally, and Marine Le Pen. And Marine Le Pen is, of course, extrovertedly anti-immigrant and anti-migrant. And her argument is that a migrant could never care for a place. And in fact, her kind of ethno-nationalist chauvinism and anti-immigrant stance is by definition ecological. And she makes the argument that migrants could never care for a place because they have no home. That sort of confluence of ecological thinking and xenophobic ethno-nationalism really tweaked my attention.
And Trump, I think, and people like Steve Bannon would share that.
Yeah,
and Orban in Hungary also takes a similar line.
Totally. And you're like, well, hang on a second. How could ecologists and people that are interested in local community be sharing intellectual space with Le Pen and Orban and Bannon? How does that make sense? And I think in part it makes sense because it's rooted in this idea that to care for a place means long tenure and somehow that certain kinds of people belong in certain kinds of places. And what I see in the movement of poor and working class and racialized populations out of the city is not a defeat, but a different kind of mobility and a kind of refusal, a kind of a reordering of political sensibilities in the same way that migrants challenge that same kind of notion. And the idea that somehow migrants are by definition anti-ecological or could not care for a place as much as people who have been there for generations is just patently untrue. That's a lie. And that there's mountains of evidence to support that. And to me then, I begin to think through, well, what does political organizing look like? If it's not in defense of a community, if it's not about trying to defend or resist gentrification or displacement, if it could be that and something else too, how could it be organized with people that have been, who have been mobile, who have just arrived, who come from all different places of the world, but have only been here for a short period of time?
I mean, this makes, I guess, some theoretical sense, although I'm not convinced by the argument that just because Le Pen and environmentalists both value rootedness, it somehow undermines the environment, the traditional environmental position. They can agree on the same thing for different reasons. But anyway, when are we seeing the politics of this? We live in an age, again, Matt, you don't need me to tell you this, particularly in the US, of geriatric control of our politics. In November, two really out of sorts 80-year-olds will fight the election. When are we going to see the political manifestation of what you're talking about this new energy, this new exuberance of the suburbs? When are leaders going to emerge and organize parties or other initiatives so that we can hear more about them and they can actually change the world?
What did you say? Out of sorts octogenarians? Is that what you called?
You said out of touch, they said.
Out of touch. I mean, but
to put it mildly, that's it. This is a children's show, so we have to be careful what we say, Matt. But you know what we mean. I mean, men who are about as detached from the real world and certainly the world you know as anyone could conceivably be. Mm-hmm. I mean, Biden, who lives in the 50s, and we know where Trump lives in his own head.
Yeah, you know, and it's interesting too. It's that, and that's also reflected in many ways in terms of generational wealth here too, and just the sheer accumulation of wealth in older and older people, and then what that means for younger populations, you know, people the age of my children, in terms of wealth and in terms of possibility. But what I found is that, and to root this around a little bit here, in terms of political thinking, is that when I left the neighborhood that I had raised my family in and spent most of my adult life in, due to this kind of endemic, you know, gentrification and unaffordability, it felt like a loss in lots of ways. It felt like a defeat. And that's the way much of traditional urbanism wants to view gentrification, as an unfettered, unresistible force. And there's a line radical urbanists often use to say that no place has ever successfully resisted gentrification. Whether or not that's true, like specifically, it's generalizably true. That once a neighborhood becomes attractive to capital, it's almost impossible for social movements to resist. And we know that from example after example after example. People recognize that in their own cities just instinctively. But I would like to reframe that, and I would like to think that not as a defeat, but as a kind of refusal of some other kinds of possibilities. And to me, that's what the suburbs have opened up for me personally, what I think politically can open up for us. Not as these inscrutable kind of black holes, but as thinking of places that are full of new kinds of vibrancy and new kinds of possibility. And what I've found in my own organizing are kinds of possibilities and kinds of organizing frames that were previously unavailable to me. That is to say that the idea and the energy and the possible flexibility for new forms of social organizing in Surrey, but in so many places, certainly in suburbs outside of London and outside of Rabat, I think of, and I think of maybe more than anything of Ferguson. There is a reason that so much of the incredible, vibrant organizing around racial justice in the United States started in Ferguson, which is a sleepy,
right, and we know most people would have never heard of Ferguson before the Black Lives Matter movement. Let's end with Ferguson, Matt. You spent some time there for this book. What did you find, and excuse the pun here, what is concrete about what's happening in Ferguson that tells us about the future of not urban, but perhaps suburban politics, and gives us some hope?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and same as you, you know, when I heard that there were, you know, riots around police violence and police murders in Ferguson, I presume you and most everybody else just assumed it was some kind of inner city neighborhood in St. Louis. I'd never heard of it. It's tiny. And so I was shocked to hear that it was a suburb. And it was a suburb that not that long ago was almost entirely white. That in the last 30 years really has gone through a slow arc, like so many other suburbs, to become almost entirely Black. And upon arriving there, it looked like so many other suburbs I've seen. Kind of scattered, without a whole lot of, you know, walkable or central or high street kind of areas. But it didn't look, you know, certainly with some pockets of poverty, but it didn't look like all that much, honestly. It just looked like, you know, a suburban place. And so the question of why then, why did so much vibrancy, so much organizing energy, and so much inspiration, why and how did it come from that place? And in many ways, I think that's the right place to ask that question is, why did that incredible explosion of new political energy come from that place that I personally would never have expected it to come from? And that arc mirrors so much of what I've seen in suburbs and so much of what gives me so much hope.
I take your point on Ferguson, but this is another subject, maybe even the subject of another book, Matt. There was, of course, an explosion, literally, metaphorically, in Ferguson, but wasn't it rather like the Occupy movement? You don't hear much about it now. And how much of America really changed because of Ferguson?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. And I think what, just the incredible prevalence and the incredible vibrancy of the ongoing Black Lives Matter movement, and after that kind of organizing, you know, the explosion of protests and stuff, what I noticed in St. Louis, and what I've seen in so many other places, is that energy then went into deeper organizing movements. And there is an unbelievable defund movement in St. Louis that is as successful as any that I've seen. That certainly is located in many ways in the city of St. Louis, but has still gained so much of its energy, from Ferguson, but from other suburbs like it, and which is really a reversal in so many ways of the political expectations we have about political change across North America, is that all of those movements would be instigated and started and find their energy and their vibrancy and their depth from an inner city, when the reverse is actually the truth. It doesn't start in inner city and filter out. So many of these movements start outside the city and then begin to filter back in.